A number we heard this week underlines a shift that continues in our economy. Even though the economy grew in 2010, median income actually fell. Some people are winning big, others are losing, and for decades, the gap between them has been growing.
That leads over time to a huge difference in the accumulated wealth of different families. And this morning, we'll report on the gap between white and black families. The average white family has 20 times the wealth of the typical black family, according to the Pew Research Center. That is the biggest wealth gap in 25 years. NPR's Pam Fessler starts a two-part series with the story of two families, one white, one black.
Demetra Williams and Stephanie Upp aren't that different in many ways. Both were raised by single mothers who struggled financially. Both worked hard to get where they are today. But just listen to how these two California women describe basically the same thing. First, Demetra, 40, African American, a single mother of one, who just started her own business.
It's funny, you know, the American dream is sort of steeped in this myth of, you know, work hard, be self-sufficient, you know, and push yourself forward, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that kind of thing. But much of the wealth in this country was not built on that in no way, fashion, or form.
And now here's Stephanie, 43, white, mother of two, part-time consultant.
You know, I think about the little things that, like when I went to college, when I graduated, you know, my mom had enough resources to give me her car so that I had a car to get to work so that I could earn money that I could then save to help put me into the next position that I could then save more money and have opportunities. So it wasn't like we had a lot, but there was enough. I didn't do it all by myself.
And that's the difference. White families are more likely than blacks and Hispanics to enjoy certain economic advantages, even, and this is important, when their incomes are similar. Often it's the subtle things, help from mom and dad with a down payment on a home or with college tuition, or a tax break on money passed from one generation to the next. Tom Shapiro of Brandeis University has tracked hundreds of families for almost 30 years. He says the gap perpetuates itself.
The larger the amount of financial wealth a family starts with, the more financial wealth it accumulated over that period of time.
In other words, it's easier to get richer if you already are. Since African Americans and Hispanics are less likely to have much wealth to begin with, they're less likely to have money to invest in the stepping stones to success, a small business or college or home. Let's go back to Stephanie Upp.
Cowboy Ned and Andy. Have you read that one yet?
She, her husband Ben Corson, and their two children live in a small bungalow in Oakland. Tonight, they've snuggled on the couch for bedtime reading. Three-year-old Calder sits on Dad's lap as six-year-old Claire reads.
Sir Kay was eager to register for the jousting.
This family is well on its way to achieving the American dream. Ben works in software. Stephanie consults for nonprofits.
Good eyes. And is that your three P's?
But Stephanie credits her success, in part, to something that happened a long time ago. When her parents divorced, her mother insisted on keeping their home in suburban Kansas. They didn't have much money, but they had stability and good schools, where college was a given and expectations high.
In my mind, there wasn't a question that I would have a richer life than I grew up with, both financially and then also in terms of experience.
College led to grad school and a career, then Ben. They started a family, and when they wanted to buy their first house, they got an unexpected boost.
We were able to have a down payment for this house, thanks to my great aunt.
Great aunt Dottie left the couple $60,000 in her will.
So that definitely helped us.
Tom Shapiro of Brandeis says inheritance is big when it comes to the racial wealth gap. White families are four times more likely than blacks to inherit. And when they do, the median inheritance is 10 times greater. Now Stephanie and Ben plan to leverage their house into a new and bigger one and better schools.
Okay, Claire, back. Good night, sweetie.
Stephanie says they aren't rich, but they have options. Claire reads a poem painted on the wall above her bed.
You have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes, you can steer yourself any direction you choose. Dr. Seuss.
Choices and expectations. Experts say they can make all the difference.
When you don't have enough money to make any mistakes, the bottom line is you just don't, you know, there's no room.
Today, Demetra Williams thinks she finally has choices. Her home healthcare business in Berkeley is getting off the ground, and she beams when her 18-year-old daughter, Yvonne, talks about getting into Mount Holyoke for college.
I applied to so many.
But she did. She applied to about 23, 24 schools. I'll say the numbers. and she was offered admission and scholarships to about 18 of them. So I'm very, very proud.
But it's been a very, very tough journey. Only 12 years ago, Demetra and her daughter were poor and homeless. Demetra says in her family, growing up in Texas, education was not a priority, and college wasn't in the cards.
My plan was to work and start my family.
Unlike Stephanie's mother, Demetra's didn't own a home, not uncommon among Black and Hispanic families. In fact, about a third have no assets at all, double the rate for whites. No home equity, no mortgage interest deduction, and certainly no great aunt Dottie.
There was no cushion, you know, for me to go back to. So the reality for me was either make things work and or be homeless, you know. I remember my grandmother telling us we could do anything we wanted to do.
But, she says, not how to do it. Like an inheritance, financial know-how is key. Stuart Butler of the Heritage Foundation says families that don't expect to climb the economic ladder often don't acquire the skills to do so. He says some Blacks, especially after decades of discrimination, can be discouraged about their prospects.
If somebody thinks they will not succeed, there is a high probability that they won't succeed. Because if they don't expect to go to college, if they don't expect to be affluent, they start doing things with that in mind.
Like not planning for the future. Demetra attended one college briefly at the urging of a school counselor, but dropped out when she realized she didn't have the right skills. Instead, she started a family. When she and Yvonne's father split, her income wasn't enough. Demetra and her daughter wound up homeless, then in public housing.
It was really hard.
But here's where her story takes a turn. Demetra was poor, but smart. With the help of a housing authority savings program, she eventually returned to college and got her degree.
She's the first one to go to college in her family, by the way. Just throwing it out there.
Demetra also got Yvonne into private schools through a special program for inner-city youth. Nonprofits helped her to save money for tutors and a business. Today, she thinks she might be breaking the cycle.
Families of color in particular are becoming much more knowledgeable and much more aware on how to create wealth here in America, because I think there is a formula for it, and it's not work hard and do well. Most poor people work really hard.
She says she's still working hard to catch up, but that Yvonne, at least, is going into the world with the head start she never had. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
And tomorrow we'll hear about efforts to narrow the racial wealth gap. This is NPR News.
You know the old saying, the rich get richer? Well, here's a troubling caveat. Those getting richer are also disproportionately white. Blacks and also Hispanics are falling further behind. Researchers say that wealth gap will widen even more unless something breaks the cycle. NPR's Pam Fessler has our second report on closing the economic divide.
Kindergartners in San Francisco are getting something new this fall besides a backpack and pencils, their own college savings account.
It's all about building aspirations in that child's mind.
City Treasurer Jose Cisneros says the city will deposit $50 in each account, $100 for those who get free and reduced price lunches. Local nonprofits will match parents' contributions up to another $200. Modest amounts, but Cisneros says in a city where many public school children are poor, it's more the message than the money.
When a child grows up and sees, oh, look at this, concrete evidence, a college savings account, my name on it, that must mean I'm going. And we wanted to bring that kind of success to San Francisco.
So basically what we're going to do in this exercise is on the first table, number one.
In the city's financial district, Tatiana Siegenthaler stands in front of a class. She's teaching several low-income adults how to calculate their debt-to-income ratio. They have to take this financial management course to get a matched savings account with a nonprofit called EARN.
On the bottom, you're going to write your total monthly income. And
these two programs are part of an effort nationwide to narrow what's often called the racial wealth gap. The Pew Research Center found recently that the median white household has net assets worth about 20 times that of the typical Black or Hispanic family. Assets such as housing, savings, and investments, minus any debt. Ben Mangan, who runs the nonprofit group EARN, says the gap itself is only making the problem worse.
The fact is, communities of color have less of the dollars across the generations. And so they're at a disadvantage in their ability to invest in the things that would allow them to get ahead.
things such as a college education, a business, or a home. So his group, as well as the city of San Francisco, the federal government, and others, are trying to do what they can to turn the tide. First of all, by encouraging more low-income families to save.
Hi. Come in! Come in!
Helena Edwards greets her half-sister and her two children. They've just arrived at Edwards' three-bedroom condo in the Bayview section of San Francisco.
What was he eating?
Edwards bought this place about a year ago after she, her partner, their daughter, a niece, and a nephew were about to be thrown into the streets.
The apartment we was living at, the landlord went into foreclosure, and he didn't tell us.
First, Edwards was able to get the eviction delayed. Then, with the help of Earn, she started a match savings account for a down payment on a home. She also got financial advice. Edwards grew up in foster care. No one really showed her how to handle money, let alone how to buy a house.
That was stuff that I never knew about. Never. I don't even know anyone who owned a house but one person.
She learned how to have money automatically withheld from her paycheck and put into a savings account. And then she got her favorite tip of all.
It is called the credit card condom.
A credit card condom to help control debt.
It's a little envelope you put over your credit card and you write your goal. And every time you use that credit card, you gotta pull it out that sleeve. So you gotta read, do I need this or do I need to save for a house?
Now that she's got her house, Edwards says she can focus on other things, such as finishing her college education. Tom Shapiro of Brandeis University says families that participate in these individual development accounts, as they're called, have shown promising results.
Their foreclosure rates have been much lower. Their savings are much higher. Indicators around their children's education are much better. But we're talking about maybe thousands of families, not even tens of thousands in a state.
And there are millions who need help. These programs are also expensive. San Francisco's kindergarten to college accounts will cost the city about $500,000 a year. Shapiro says it will take a lot more than that to narrow a gap that's so firmly entrenched. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The jobs bill that President Obama sent to Congress this week includes payroll tax cuts, infrastructure spending, and more, a total cost of $447 billion. The next question is how to keep that from expanding the nation's debt. While many Republicans are skeptical the plan will work, they're even less enamored with how the president wants to pay for it, ending many tax breaks for wealthy individuals and corporations. Here's NPR's David Wellner.
To offset the cost of creating jobs for possibly millions of idled workers, President Obama is asking this of Congress: make rich people pay more taxes. Households with annual incomes of more than $250,000 would have tax deductions for mortgages and charitable contributions capped. Firms with corporate jets would get a smaller annual tax break. Hedge fund managers would have to pay income tax rather than the much lower capital gains tax. Yesterday at a Columbus, Ohio high school, President Obama presented some stark choices.
We've got to decide what our priorities are. Do you want to keep tax loopholes for oil companies?
No!
Or do you want to renovate more schools like Fort Hays so that construction workers have jobs again? Do you want to keep tax breaks for multimillionaires and billionaires? Do you want to put teachers back to work and help small businesses and cut taxes for middle-class families?
Back at the Capitol, Republicans were having none of it. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell accused the president of pushing permanent tax hikes to finance a temporary economic stimulus. McConnell saw no chance of Congress accepting the president's so-called pay-fors.
I don't think the pay-fors are going to go anywhere because we know these are not new ideas. The pay-fors have all been around the track before, and there is bipartisan opposition to every one of them.
Indeed, there are conservative Democrats, such as Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, who, like virtually every Republican, oppose making anyone pay more taxes.
Effectively raising taxes is, in this point of time, in my opinion, is not the way to go.
But other Democrats say the president's right to lean on the wealthy to pay for his jobs bill. Dick Durbin, who's the Senate's number two Democrat, says it's Republicans who insist the bill be paid for.
I mean, if they've got other sources to pay for it, let's hear from them. But, you know, it isn't going to be a matter of cutting spending to create tax cuts for working people. At some point, some Republicans have to step up and acknowledge that one more penny in taxes on the wealthiest people in America is not punitive.
The White House says there is another way to pay for the jobs bill, and that's by letting the newly formed Super Committee on Deficit Reduction come up with a plan to offset its costs. John Kyle, who's the Senate's number two Republican, is on that committee. He cannot see that panel trying to find the pay-fors to underwrite the president's plan.
First of all, it assumes that the committee members will agree with his stimulus program. I don't think they will. But secondly, that we'll just volunteer to find a way to pay for it. He said it's paid for. Well, it's only paid for, apparently, if this Joint Select Committee can figure out a way to pay for it. We've got a big enough problem of coming up with $1.5 trillion in savings.
At the Super Committee's very first hearing yesterday, Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Elmendorf was the sole witness. His main message, raising taxes now, is not a good idea, but neither is cutting spending.
The combination of fiscal policies likely to be most effective would be policies that cut taxes or increase spending in the near term, but over the medium and longer term, move in the opposite direction and cut spending or raise taxes.
But Elmendorf did not specify just whose taxes should eventually be raised. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Over the last few weeks, we've been looking back to 2009. It was a time when the economy was in the throes of recession and a time when President Obama was still new to that problem and also to his office. We've gone back to a series of interviews I did with people on a road trip across the country to commemorate President Obama's first 100 days in office. Recently, I called back the owner of a houseboat company in Kentucky who had to lay off all 27 of his workers back in 2009. We also reached back to two elderly ladies who have breakfast and talk politics every week together in Indiana. But the group of Americans who are arguably the most affected by the faltering economy in recent years are young people. On that trip a couple years ago, I met a lot of college students and recent grads, all working at Stone Soup Kitchen, a greasy spoon diner in Atlanta. The kitchen manager at the time was Sam Terrell. He was also doubling as a hip-hop musician in an up-and-coming Atlanta group called Supreme. He gave his thoughts on the economy a backbeat.
This is called The Best Years right here.
This is the best times of my life right now. This is the best years of my life.
Sort of a dramatic, kind of a dark beat with the dark violins and then he's sort of droning on in the chorus like, these are the best years of my life. And we're kind of being ironic because...
Kind of being ironic, but for Sam in 2009, the recession wasn't all that bad. As he saw it, it was a good excuse to hang back and not make any big decisions about the future.
I think it's more of an opportunity than anything to take this time now to go back to school and save whatever money I can.
And we managed to track Sam down again. Sam, I understand you've made your way from Atlanta to New York.
Yeah. I'm in Hyde Park, New York right now.
And what are you up to?
I'm attending the Culinary Institute of America. I'm 2 years into school now and looking to do another year and a half maybe for the bachelor's program.
And remind me how old you are?
26.
26. So what do you think? You heard your voice there. You, at the time, yeah, in 2009, said the recession was, you know, an okay excuse to not make those big decisions. Are you still feeling like the economic troubles are opportunity for you?
Not as optimistic as I may have seemed, but still in the same boat, I would say. After 2 years, you know, I'm pretty much following that same thought process I was on. Go to school, get a degree, lay low, not worry about trying to be a really big force in the job market right now.
Well, what do you think of the restaurant catering industry? I mean, you're in culinary school. The job possibilities looking good, not so optimistic?
I'm pretty optimistic about getting a job when I graduate. I think the restaurant industry has been doing fairly well considering the recession. You know, people still really want to go out and have a good meal, and people always need food.
You know, when I stopped at Stone Soup Kitchen, the Atlanta restaurant where you were working, it was such a happy environment, but I could hear the fear about, you know, what the future would hold, what that recession in 2009 would do to the country. How do you feel in general about, you know, your generation, people in their 20s who are graduating from schools and looking ahead?
I feel like a lot of my friends are kind of in limbo and don't really know exactly where they want to go, but at the same time, they don't seem too worried. I don't think it really keeps them up at night. I don't feel like we're panicking too much.
When would you hit the panic button?
If I don't find a job quickly right after I graduate, which I'm not too worried about because being a graduate of an institute, it's pretty easy to find a job in that level. But I guess when I would start to panic is maybe a few more years down the line when I maybe want to settle down or have a nicer apartment in a better neighborhood, or maybe if I am still making that much money and things get worse and I can't support myself.
It's interesting because we have a lot of reports and conversations on the air about how bad the economy is right now, how it might be, you know, it could be in rough shape for a sustained period of time. What gives you that level of hope? And when you read those headlines and hear things on television and on the radio?
I don't know, maybe luck in the past, maybe naivety.
But feeling naive, but in a good way.
Yeah, maybe just that I'm young and haven't really had my back up against the wall just yet. I mean, in general, about the economy and the recession, I'm not very hopeful.
Why is that?
I thought by now things would have gotten better.
We've been chatting with Sam Terrell. He's a culinary student and aspiring musician. Good luck, Sam, and thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, David Green.